Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Pope Francis makes history on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most.
Mr. Speaker, the Pope of the Holy See.
Before a packed chamber today, Francis became the first pope to address a joint meeting of the House and the Senate. He called for unity and denounced political and ideological polarization, but he did not shy away from Washington's most divisive issues. They included abortion, same-sex marriage, and climate change, each provoking a standing ovation from a different part of the audience. Afterward, there was no handshaking with dignitaries. The pope had a meeting with homeless people. Today's talking point, South America's longest guerrilla war may be ending after 50 years. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To The Point. As the first vicar of Christ to address a joint meeting of Congress today, Pope Francis delivered challenges to both political parties. In addition to abortion and global warming, he also addressed the death penalty and the arms trade. We'll hear excerpts of his historic speech and sample reactions. Today's talking point, after 50 years of brutal guerrilla warfare, both the government of Colombia and the so-called FARC rebels have set a deadline to complete a peace deal. We'll hear about an agreement reached yesterday in Havana. First is news update. Saudi Arabia takes pride in hosting the Hajj every year when millions of Muslims travel to Mecca. But once again, the pilgrimage has turned deadly. Less than 2 weeks ago, a construction crane crashed, killing 111 people. Today, 6 miles from Mecca, more than 700 were killed and almost 900 were injured in a stampede. Ben Hubbard is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Ben, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Do we know the cause of this?
Well, there was some kind of a crowd control failure, obviously. We don't know all the exact details, but Saudi officials today pulled out a map of the area and said that basically you had two large groups of pilgrims that were trying to access one of the holy sites, and they basically ran into each other on a series of narrow streets where there were few ways to get out, and a stampede ensued in which over 700 people were trampled to death and another more than 800 people were injured.
What about the site itself? You said it's one of the holy sites. Which one?
Well, this comes in the middle of the yearly Hajj pilgrimage, which about 2 million Muslims take per year in Saudi Arabia. And this is a specific site where there are a number of walls that come, and the pilgrims throw a number of pebbles at the walls in a ritual that symbolizes stoning the devil. This happened a little ways from there in an area where there are a bunch of air-conditioned tents where many of the pilgrims stay. So it wasn't actually at the site, but it was apparently large groups of pilgrims who were trying to reach the site and ended up getting stuck and running into each other.
Has this been a continuing problem for Saudi Arabia?
Well, it depends on how far back you want to go. I mean, if you all throughout history, there have been many disasters that have happened there. Saudi government has invested billions of dollars in recent years to try to update the site and increase access and transportation and things like that. And the situation has gotten better. The last sort of mass casualty event that we had at on the pilgrimage was in 2006. And so in recent years, it used to be that, these would happen very, very frequently. And so it did seem like the situation had gotten better in recent years. But then when we have, incidents like today, it raises very big questions over exactly what went wrong and, how something like this could have happened.
So this happened about 6 miles from Mecca itself. What about the collapse of the crane a couple of weeks ago?
Well, that was a separate incident. Very bad timing for Saudi Arabia. That was, there's as I said, the government is investing all kinds of money in updating the site. They're, building, all kinds of sites that are going to include the world's largest hotel and things right around the Grand Mosque in Mecca. And in that particular case, there was a kind of a surprise storm that hit, and amid heavy winds and rain, a giant construction crane that was there working on one of the sites toppled over, and part of it crashed through the roof of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, which also holds houses the Kaaba, the black box that, you know, people walk around as part of their pilgrimage.
This is so important.
That incident killed about just over 110, about 110 people in that incident, which is just 1 week ago.
And 300 or 400 injured as well. This is so important to so many people, with 2 million a year gathering, as you indicated. Is it embarrassing to the Saudi government to when these disasters occur?
Well, it's definitely embarrassing to the Saudi government. I mean, this is a government that portrays itself as sort of the world leaders of Orthodox Islam. You know, one of the king's most commonly used titles is the custodian of the two holy mosques. And so, you know, he sort of even built his position as the monarch as being personally responsible for ensuring the security both of the sites and of the visitors. So, yeah, things, you know, when you have huge accidents like this, it is terribly embarrassing for the kingdom.
So what is the Saudi government doing about it, or is there at this point anything they can do?
Well, it's been a bit unclear. I mean, we've had a number of official statements today. The interior minister, who is also the crown prince, has been put in charge of a high-level investigative committee that's supposed to look into this and find out exactly what happened. King Salman himself just gave a speech that was aired on TV addressing members of the security forces, and he as well said, you know, we have to get to the bottom of what happened here. And, you know, I mean, Saudi has a somewhat spotty record with investigating itself. I think after the crane disaster, there has been some information that's come out, and they are holding the contracting company responsible. But we'll just have to see where this goes, and whether it was a very local failure, whether it was a more systematic failure in the crowd control procedures, we'll just have to wait and see.
I see from your report in the New York Times that there's 4,000 emergency workers have been sent, and that 4 hospitals are available. So obviously they're trying to get up and running.
Well, and Saudi officials and Saudi citizens, what they will emphasize about this is the severe complexity of holding an event like this. I mean, we're talking about 2 million people coming from around the world, coming from, you know, everywhere from West Africa, South America, Southeast Asia. People speaking dozens of different languages, all converging and trying to go through a fairly specific set of rituals in a limited amount of time. And so there's a massive, massive logistical effort
here.
All
right, Ben Hubbard again, and excuse me for interrupting, but we're out of time. Ben Hubbard in Beirut for the New York Times. Good to have you with us. In a moment, Pope Francis makes history on Capitol Hill. This is To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're in Alney, back with To the Point. Speaking slowly and in heavily accented English, Pope Francis said he was grateful today for a historic invitation.
To address this joint session of Congress in the land of the free at the home of the brave.
That familiar phrase got a standing ovation from Republicans, Democrats, and even the 4 present members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Ines San Martin is Vatican correspondent for Crux. That's the Boston Globe's website that focuses on the Catholic Church. Good to have you back on our program.
It's good to be back, and I'm going to warn the audience, just like Pope Francis, my accent, my English might be heavily accented, since I'm also Argentinian.
With all due respect to the Pope, I think you're doing fine, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We can understand you very clearly. So how important was this historic event for Congress? How important was it to the Pope?
I think to the Pope it was an extraordinary opportunity to talk to the American people, to tell them, I know you had this idea of me maybe not loving your country. I know you have this idea of me not knowing your country very well. He came full on today, naming 4 really important figures of the United States, telling the American people, I know you guys, I've been reading about you, I've been researching about you, and I'm here to talk as an insider and trying to push you to be the best version of yourself. You know, he quoted two non-Catholic, very well-known non-Catholic Americans, such as Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King, and then two very well-known Catholics were Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton. And, you know, basically he was telling them, you guys are great. I mean, well, telling the States, you guys are great when you're at your best. And these four people, for Pope Francis, are the best of the United States at this moment. So I think it was historic, you know, for Pope Francis to be able to just come out and say it. You guys are great. Because that's what he said. That's what I heard, I guess.
He also said that we ought to get past what he referred to as polarization. Was he referring directly, do you think, to the kind of divisions that we have here in this country? We hear the word polarization described as definitive of what's going on Capitol Hill.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I said before, I'm an Argentinian, and I always have a really hard time to understand American politics in how polarized absolutely everything is. I mean, you saw it today in Congress. You know, people were giving Pope Francis standing ovations, and those who were doing so on one issue were not doing it in the other, and they were completely opposite sides of the street. And some of the issues were actually not that polarizing. Yet people were, no, that's not my issue. I'm not going to stand up. I'm not going to clap. And it was very, very obvious that, you know, things were polarized today, and things are polarized in this country and everything. I mean, we see it daily on the, you know, presidential campaign that's going on right now.
Let's hear a bit of what the Pope had to say about one of the most contentious issues in this country, and that, of course, is immigration.
We, the people of this continent, are not fearful of foreigners, because most of us because most of us were once foreigners.
Xavier Becerra is a Democratic congressman from Los Angeles. He is chair of the Democratic Caucus. He, of course, was there today. And, Congressman, it's great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
First, before we get to the question of immigration, your reaction as a Catholic yourself to the visit of the Pope on Capitol Hill.
As a Catholic, as the son of immigrants, as someone of Latino heritage, as someone who has a father who still speaks with broken English, very personal, very moving, and I am thrilled to hear the leader of the Catholic Church, of which I'm a part, speak so forcefully and so explicitly about the need to take these things on and be courageous.
What about the question specifically of immigration? Do you think, if we heard Ines San Martin say that different people got up and applauded at different points, do you think there'll be any change as a result of what the Pope had to say?
Well, it's hard to say that simply from hearing the Pope that those who have been reluctant to help us reform a broken immigration system will all of a sudden do an about-face. But I think it becomes more difficult when you see the weight of all those who are behind a reform of our immigration laws to stand against that. And so whether that moves some of the politicians, I guarantee you there are a whole bunch of folks back home who are constituents who heard the Pope and I hope are stirred to action as well. And we'll see. We'll see, because we do react as elected officials to what our constituents say.
Representative Javier Becerra from Los Angeles. John Fahiri is with us, Republican strategist, director of the Quinn Gillespie & Associates lobbying firm, columnist for The Hill as well. Good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren. How you doing?
Good. You were outside, I take it, with the tens of thousands of people who were out there on the Capitol Mall.
Yeah, it was a heck of a sight. We got there bright and early, about 6:15, which we didn't have to get there, but it was really a sight to see the speech outside and see the Pope come out and kind of address the crowd with a prayer. It was really an unbelievable day.
You're a Catholic too, as I understand it. So let me ask you for your personal response.
Well, I didn't hear the earlier comments, but I thought the Pope gave a very, you know, nuanced speech. I think that you know, he's not a political figure. Obviously, he wants policy results, but he's not a political figure. So I think that on both sides of the aisle, you had plenty of things to food to think about. You know, I think it was, the typical kind of Catholic doctrine thought, which was, you know, we have to take care of the poor, and you know, we have to take care of some of the earth. And I thought it was a good speech. That was my personal opinion.
The Pope, of course, addressed many issues, as I indicated at the outset, and as Inesima San Martin told us as well. One of them appeared to be gay marriage, and here's what he had to say in what is regarded as code words about that.
I cannot hide my concern for the family, which is threatened, perhaps as never before, from within and without.
John Fiore, do you see that as a Republican, as an indication of his concern about same-sex marriage?
Yeah, I do. I thought he really hit on all the points that shouldn't be of any surprise to any Catholic or anybody who observes the Catholic Church. I mean, he's concerned about gay marriage. He's concerned about climate change. He really didn't. I didn't think he veered away from his script at all. I think everything he said was very predictable and very much in line with social thought from the Catholic Church.
Congressman Becerra, will that, do you think, make some people uncomfortable who are supportive of same-sex marriage?
I think not. I thought he was very thoughtful in the way he approached that. Everyone understood where the Pope and the Church stood on that particular issue. And my sense was he said it in such an eloquent way and such a thoughtful way that someone like me, who is very much in support of gay marriage and gay rights and the LGBT community having the same rights, felt like he was making an accommodation, as he has in the past, to tell people, I'm more interested in being inclusive than exclusive.
So he's not changing the stance of the Catholic Church toward that institution.
Actually, I think he has. By addressing it in a far more thoughtful way, I think any predecessor pope probably would have been much more direct. And my sense from listening to Pope Francis is that he's trying to, as I said, be inclusive, be responsible to the Church and its teachings, but be inclusive as well. And there's nothing that I find in the Bible that says to me that a man and a woman have to be the only form of love, of a loving relationship. And so I think these are the things that we see evolve over time. And I think the fact that the Pope was very thoughtful in how he said this is an evolution.
Let's take a look at another issue that the Pope addressed today, and that is climate change.
To avert the most serious effects of the environmental deterioration caused by human activity.
So there's the crux, if I may say it, of the matter, that is that environmental deterioration is caused by human activity. Back to you, Congressman Becerra. Is this, do you think, indication from the Holy See that, in fact, he wants to see action?
Yeah, there's no equivocation on the part of the Pope on this one. And it almost goes in, flies in the face of the climate change deniers to believe that they can do so. But if I could say two quick things on that, Warren. One, how powerfully he speaks now about climate change and how it's indispensable that we must take action. But two, he couches it by saying, by the way, we do this because it's the most vulnerable among us who will be hurt the most. And I think that's important because the entire environmental community has to recognize that as we push for climate change reform and all the rest, we got to remember that we got to do stuff that will help the poor who are impacted most directly by climate change.
And, of course, the poor in this country are getting more than just a nod from the Pope today after he finished his speech. He didn't stand around and shake hands with the leaders of Congress. He went to visit with homeless people in Washington. John Fiore, back to you. How do Republicans respond to this and to the appeal, not just on the grounds of what we need to do in terms of industrialism and the way that wealth is used, but rather the impact of climate change on the least among us?
Well, listen, I think there would be varied responses amongst different kind of groups of Republicans. I take the message to heart. I've said in the past that we need to be very careful with our environment, that we have to acknowledge that, you know, we have a responsibility to the earth, because I agree with the Pope. I mean, I think it has impacts on the most vulnerable, but it has impacts on all of us, and it just makes sense. I think the some conservatives will be concerned about the president, the Pope's talk on the environment, but others will embrace it, and I think that that's kind of where the party is not going to come down as one. I think that if you're Catholic, you have to really kind of take this to heart, that we have to protect our environment.
Let me go back to Inés San Martín at the Vatican for the Crooks, the Boston Globe website. The Pope read from and made more than one reference to his encyclical on climate change. This is obviously something that he takes very seriously.
Yes, it is. And if I might say so, he's definitely not the first pope to talk about climate change and to talk about the need to care for creation, as he puts it. Because I don't know if you remember, but Pope Benedict XVI was famously labeled the Green Pope because of everything he did, not only his rhetoric in favor of the environment, but also what he did inside the Vatican, like, for example, installing solar panels, making the audience hall one of the greenest places in the world, actually. The Vatican has zero carbon footprint, which is a historical, and it's the only state in the world that has it. Pope Francis is just building up on that and telling the world we need to act now. This is a historic year when it comes to those who believe in climate change, as the Church now, I mean, as Pope Francis does and Pope Benedict before him did, because we, as you know, we have the United Nations Assembly that's going to deal with it, and then we have Paris. So it's a moment to start talking, and it's a moment to start making action, and that's what Pope Francis is doing, just calling everyone to action.
Back to Congressman Becerra. You, before the Pope's speech, released a series of videos. A series of videos calling upon him to address certain issues or raising certain issues, including income inequality and an increase in the minimum wage. Were you satisfied with what he had to say?
He certainly struck the right chords. Many members were hoping to somehow convey to him their feelings and how they wanted to make sure that he knew what people in America were thinking. So we put together this video with many members. We touched on the three principal issues that we thought he should broach, and of course he did: climate change, immigration, and economic opportunity. And so I think we couldn't have asked for more, and I think, as John has said, he did it in a way that was thoughtful and really approached everyone's sensibilities.
John Feary, back to you again, our Republican strategist, also a Catholic who watched the speech from outside in the Capitol Mall. Does the Pope, do you think, appear to be in a very polarized environment, more on the side of Democrats than he is on the side of Republicans?
Oh, I think he's on the side of God. and I think he probably looks at the political polarization in Congress and really wants us on both sides to get our act together, because America has a leadership role in the world, and we have to seize it and, you know, do things that make sense and that are consistent with taking care of the earth and trying to ease suffering across the globe. So I don't think the Pope leans either way. I think he's a non-political figure, but he cares about humanity, and he wants America to continue its leadership role, which I completely agree with him about.
Given what we've heard from the candidates for president on the Republican side, do you think there will be any change, clearly, on climate change, on same-sex marriage, on abortion, on various other issues as well? Not abortion, excuse me. The Pope, of course, is very much opposed to that. But do you think that we'll see any change, John Feary, as a result of what he has said today?
I don't think that American politicians, necessarily take their marching orders from the Pope. I think that his words were inspiring. I think that there have been several Republicans, including me, who have spoken out on climate change and think that we have to take a more nuanced approach and not necessarily be agnostic on climate change, but look forward to finding solutions. I don't think it's going to have much of an impact on the political debate, because American politics is distinct from what the Holy See is saying.
All right. We need to take a break. We're going to do that. Congressman Becerra, once again, chair of the Democratic Caucus, thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thanks, Warren.
We're going to continue this conversation, and later we'll talk about South America's longest guerrilla war. It may be ending. We'll hear about a deal reached yesterday between the government of Colombia and FARC rebels. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Once again, talking about the Pope's historic speech today, addressing a joint meeting of Congress, the first time that the Vicar of Christ has ever done that. And the Pope took advantage of it, spoke for almost an hour, and touched on a great many issues. He also at one point mentioned the Golden Rule, saying it reminds us of many things.
Also reminds us of our responsibility to protect and defend human life at every stage of its development.
Paul Singer is Washington correspondent for USA Today. And, Paul, it's great to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
No surprise on that one. It is said to be a code word for being opposed to abortion, and I don't think anybody was surprised by that. What sort of reaction? We've heard a bit from Javier Becerra on the Democratic side. John Fiore is still with us, a Republican strategist. What did you hear around the Capitol and from members of Congress and others as well?
You know, it is interesting. This speech really was quite nuanced. I mean, you'll notice that as he gave that statement, which was really the, you know, sort of the primary statement about abortion in this address, he then immediately pivoted and said, you know, that's one of the reasons this, you know, belief in the sanctity of life, defending human life, this is the reason that I oppose the death penalty, which is something that, of course, the Democrats could stand and clap for. In some ways, you know, the Pope is not a political person, but he clearly has a pretty keen political ear. And I think the reaction that we've seen around the Capitol since he has departed has been in some version of what you'd anticipate, is that there was plenty in here for people of both parties to hail and to claim as their own little piece of victory in the Pope's address.
He said he was joining the Catholic bishops of the United States in his opposition to the death penalty, and he called for it not just here, but all over the world.
To advocate at different levels the global abolition of the death penalty.
Paul Singer, we heard one shout there, but the applause was pretty scattered for that. The death penalty is still very popular in the United States, even though it's one of the few countries in the world that still uses it.
Yeah, I think it's actually declining popularity in the United States. You know, one of the interesting things about this speech as well is that members of Congress during State of the Union addresses frequently have sheets of paper in front of them, a copy of the speech, so they're reading along and they sort of know what's coming. I'm not sure they knew what was coming because they did not have those papers in their hands in this speech. And so I believe some of that response to the death penalty comment was actual surprise that was where he was going with that comment at that moment.
Paul Singer, once again, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Let's broaden this conversation out a bit. James Carroll is with us, distinguished writer in residence at New York University, author of Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor to be with you.
The first Catholic president of the United States was John Kennedy. That wasn't that long ago. And when he ran for office, he had to say that he was not going to be taking orders from the Pope. It was very controversial, even up to that year, 1960.
Well, John Kennedy was the emblem of what you might call the new Catholicism. Don't forget that while he was president, the Second Vatican Council was convened. And some of the things that were at issue in Kennedy's candidacy, for example, freedom of conscience, can a Catholic actually make appeals to conscience primary? That was controversial before Kennedy, before the council, but the council affirmed the primacy of conscience in a way that was new in the Catholic Church. So you're right to actually think of Kennedy and the Second Vatican Council as turning points. Pope Francis is fulfilling the momentum in the church and in the broader world that began then.
And when we talk about the freedom of conscience, what does that mean in the context of the current polarization that the Pope also talked about, where many Catholics don't necessarily agree with what he is saying? Many are approving of a woman's right to choose. Many are approving of same-sex marriage.
Well, Pope Francis is remarkable in that he doesn't assume that everyone will either agree with him or obey him. I think he assumes a diversity of responses, even within the Catholic Church. I think that's why he is so respectful in the way he speaks, even about issues on which he is uncompromising, for example, abortion. And yet his description of the heartbreaking and deeply painful situation in which women find themselves when they have to choose to terminate a pregnancy exudes compassion toward women in that situation. He's not wagging his finger in the faces of people. The respect for the conscience of the other person has become a note of Catholic faith, and it's certainly a note of this Pope's approach to everybody he meets, Catholics included, I would say.
I think every guest on this program has used the word nuanced, and I think that's what you're talking about. This is a very nuanced address and a very nuanced set of ideas. They're quite complex.
Yes, it's true, and that's why he does not speak in the imperative tone of voice. Notice this is a man who is not issuing commands. He is leading by invitation. He is exhorting people, and he's also acknowledging his own uncertainty, the complexity of these questions, even as they affect him. He's acknowledged, for example, that he's not offering recipes or strategies for solutions to vastly complicated problems, including the great problem he points to again and again, which is the effect of the world economy on the poorest of the poor. He's not offering a kind of economic fix. What he's doing is lifting up the moral complexity of these questions, but then he's insisting that the basic outcome, disastrous poverty or death rates or migrants lost at sea, that these are simply unacceptable outcomes. And pointing to the unacceptability of the outcomes is a clear invitation to do something to change them.
One thing I think that he was not nuanced about was the arms trade. He asked the question, why are deadly weapons being sold to those who plan to inflict untold suffering on individuals and society? And here's the answer.
Sadly, the answer, as we all know, is simply for money. Money that is drenched in blood.
Back to Ines San Martin, the Vatican correspondent for Crux. Is this a theme that the Pope has stressed very often?
Yeah, the Pope has stressed very often about the need to, first of all, stop trade weapons and, you know, trafficking of weapons. It once again, in accordance with the Catholic Church, less than a couple of months ago, in the last couple of months, he has several times talked about the importance of nuclear disarmament, for example, which is obviously quite in relation with what he said today about the importance of stopping weapons. Something that's been heard in Rome lately a lot is the fact that, for example, the refugee crisis in Syria and in the Middle East would be solved if gun trading was solved, because everyone knows Syria is not producing weapons, so the weapons that are actually causing the refugee crisis are actually not Syrian problems. So that's something the Pope is obviously very invested in because he's very invested in peace. So that's where this is coming from, and it's a very Pope Francis issue.
Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, back to you. The United States, of course, is the largest manufacturer and seller of weapons in the world. Do you think that the Pope was addressing himself to the Congress, which, of course, also has many defense contracts and spends more money on weapons than any other country and many other countries combined?
Yeah, well, in fact, for fun, I occasionally track the press releases that go out every time the United States sells weapon systems abroad, and there's a bunch of them. It's billions and billions of dollars a year that is brokered through the Pentagon. I don't know that the Pope was directly addressing that. It's an interesting. It's one of those things that goes on within the bowels of the U.S. government that people don't really know much about and pay much attention to. My suspicion is he was talking more about sort of the illicit arms trade that goes on around the world, and to some degree the arming of various combatants in these kind of wars. But it is an interesting point that there is an office at the Pentagon and the State Department that basically do nothing but this, is sell weapons systems abroad.
John Feary, back to you, our Republican strategist. This is pretty much a bipartisan kind of behavior on Capitol Hill. You have a big defense contract, and the subcontractors are in every congressional district.
Yeah, it was a really interesting comment, and it elicited a curious response from members of Congress. some of whom stood and applauded the Pope when he spoke those words. And as a bipartisan, like Louis Gohmert, who's a conservative Republican, got up and really was in favor of what the Pope said. And so I think it was actually largely lost on what he was trying to get at. It was just a very curious response. And I you're right. Arms trading is an important, defense contracting is an important part of the American economy. I actually thought he might have been making a comment about, the guns that are sold on American streets. And we obviously have a lot of gun violence in America. But I think he's actually making the comment more directed towards what's happening in Syria. And so it was an interesting response from members of Congress.
James Carroll, back to you. The subtitle of your book, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age. Do you think that this is a pope who is representative of the role of religion in policy? Some Republican Catholics, one of them in particular from Arizona, actually boycotted the speech because he thought that the pope had gone too far or would go too far and already had into issues that he thought were political in nature and not religious. One of the presidential candidates, Rick Santorum, has said similar kinds of things as well. But is this pope, do you think, really trying to make a difference by addressing civilian policymakers?
It's absolutely true that he is. And civilian policymakers are disingenuous when they pretend that religion has no role to play in politics. Certainly the biblical tradition, the Hebrew and Christian traditions alike, are absolutely insistent that the way in which we treat our neighbor is the way in which we treat God. There is no worshiping God without loving the neighbor. It's the basic religious principle of every mainstream religion. And that is a political message. We can't ignore, Archbishop Helder Camara of Brazil, a founder of liberation theology, famously said, "When I feed the poor, they call me a saint. When I demand that the poor be taken care of, they call me a Marxist." And there's that way in which people are happy to see charity, but they're reluctant to understand that charity isn't enough. There must be justice. This pope is being religious to the core when he is calling for justice. And politicians who don't want those messages combined are understanding neither religion nor the obligations of the Commonwealth.
There have been many reports that the Catholic Church in the United States is in trouble. Many, many people have left the faith for various reasons. Inés San Martín, back to you. Is this pope particularly concerned about that? Is he here in part because he wants to get people back into the fold?
In many ways, that's probably true. He's here as the head of the Catholic Church. He's not only the head of probably the strongest, softest power in the world. He's above all a religious leader, and he likes to say that he calls himself the Bishop of Rome. He's here to address Catholics, and the original reason for his trip, his visit to the United States, was the word meeting our family, which is a religious event. Everything else that came after, or is coming actually before Philadelphia, were things that were added to the original idea of I need to go to the United States and talk to Catholics, address Catholics, and just bring them back to the fold.
Is he also talking very directly to the growing Latino population in the United States?
He definitely is. I mean, for the last 2 days, he's already, when he's been here in the States, he said, "I'm also a son of immigrants. I'm also part of this continent. I'm Latino." It's a very direct message to all those Catholics that are coming to the United States from Latin America, as he is coming, basically. And telling them, you guys are part of the church too, but you're also part of this country. Because whether we like it or not, this country, as he said, is a country of immigrants. I have a lot of American friends, and all of them tell me I'm one-third something. No one tells me I'm American from America. Everyone has blood from a different country, and Pope Francis is saying that, and today it's Latino. So, well, let's bring the Latino church back into the Catholic Church, something that it's easily lost when you do the transition from your country to a different culture.
He's going to be addressing the United Nations next week. What do you think he's going to say there?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of things we heard today. I mean, he's probably going to talk once again about climate change, that's for sure. But something that I believe he was going to stress a lot more in the United Nations than he did today in Congress is human trafficking. This is an issue he's been interested in since he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. We're talking about the second largest illegal industry in the world, with millions of people being trafficked and enslaved, I'm sorry, every single day. And industries are actually moved because of human slavery. So that's probably the topic he's going to bring back to the table. He's actually been working on getting it into the United Nations goals for sustainability, because right now human trafficking is not one of the issues the countries are going to be voting for and addressing in the next week.
And Paul Singer, back to you, Washington correspondent for USA Today. In the meantime, he's going to be going to Philadelphia and visiting a jail there, the largest county city jail, rather, as I understand it, in Philadelphia. How much coverage do you think that will get, and what do you how do you think it'll be perceived by people around the country?
Well, it'll get a great deal of coverage, This Pope is an interesting fellow. He apparently passed up an opportunity to have lunch with members of Congress today and instead went to a Catholic Charities facility here in Washington, D.C., where they were serving lunch to the homeless. He is a man who is a service to the poor, is not only from his heart and from his mouth, but also from his hands. And I believe that throughout his trip to the United States, he's going to get a tremendous amount of coverage. I know here at USA Today, we have devoted quite a team to covering him here in Washington, but also for basically every minute that he's on American soil. We are paying a great deal of attention to his trip, and it has a significant impact. I also want to mention, that when he spoke to the bishops yesterday, he opened with a note of comment to the Jews who are celebrating Yom Kippur. Today, when he spoke to the crowd out over the in the back of the Capitol, he asked them to pray for him, and then he outreached to the non-believers as well, and said, if you can't pray, please just send me your best wishes. So he's trying to reach not just the Catholics, but across the spectrum of American culture.
We're going to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Paul Singer, once again, Washington correspondent for USA Today. James Carroll, distinguished writer in residence, New York University, Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age, his book. John Ferry, the Republican strategist, director of the Quinn Gillespie and Associates lobbying firm on Capitol Hill. Ines San Martin, Vatican correspondent for Crux, whose accent was very understandable. Thank you very much for being with us as well. And our earlier guest, Democratic Congressman Javier Becerra, chair of the Democratic Caucus, also joined us, a congressman from Los Angeles. Succeeding governments of Colombia have been fighting against the Revolutionary Armed Forces, abbreviated the FARC, for 50 years. Yesterday in Havana, Cuba, they completed the latest stage of a peace agreement. We'll hear about that in a moment on today's Talking Point.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Warman Alna here with today's Talking Point. Yesterday in Havana, representatives of the government of Colombia and the FARC rebel leaders were all dressed in white for a ceremony that the leaders of Cuba have helped to bring about. Those parties have reached stage 4 of a 6-stage peace agreement scheduled to be completed in the next 6 months. If it can be finalized, it'll mean the end of guerrilla warfare that's lasted for 50 years. Adam Isaacson studies regional security policy for the Washington Office on Latin America, that is a human rights organization. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Tell us about this process. How long has the peace process been going on?
Well, this is the fourth try with the FARC since the early 1980s. This particular round has gone on since 2012. And yesterday, it's a big deal. They just passed the hardest and toughest question of all the ones they had to figure out. And they may well be ending this 51-year-old war by March.
What is this toughest question?
Well, it was the question of, okay, how do you convince guerrillas to hand in a weapon and then perhaps go to a jail cell if they committed serious human rights abuses during the conflict. You can't do amnesties anymore. Colombia is a member of the International Criminal Court, and that just doesn't happen now. They had to find a way to square this circle. And they did, although it may mean restriction of liberty, whatever that means, for some of the guerrillas and military people who committed the worst violations, but it might not mean prison.
Okay, restriction of liberty for some of the guerrillas, but you indicated also the military. Have members of the military, particularly past members of the military, admitted to atrocities, as apparently the FARC rebels have?
They rarely admit them, but in Colombian courts and in international courts, they have been found guilty of them. The main things that the armed forces have done have been they collaborated with and helped a series of militias, pro-government militias called paramilitaries, that killed hundreds of thousands, well, tens of thousands of people in Colombia, a lot of aiding and abetting. And then there was a scandal about, 6 or 7 years ago, where they killed as many as 3,000 civilians, often just to rack up their own body counts and get rewards.
So is confession, though, still into the future? Have we yet to really see that?
You haven't seen much confession or much contrition. But in order to get this restricted liberty, whatever that is not prison, any individual who demobilizes is going to have to confess to everything they did. If it's found they're holding back or they're lying or they're denying things, then they'll go to regular prison. But if they do confess everything and they check up with all the human rights groups and make sure that they're really saying all they did and showing contrition to their victims, then maybe they'll be in some sort of arrangement like a farm or some place that they can't leave, but they probably can practice politics, you know, post things on the website, talk to the press, and not be in just stuck in some cell block for 5 to 8 years. But the term is 5 to 8 years.
One of the major human rights groups, Human Rights Watch, has said that they think they're getting off too easy. This isn't working.
They have said that, and, you know, they do have a concern. I mean, it's going to be hard seeing, some very some of the worst abusers in Colombia's history, people who have committed mass murder or rape or things like that, actually, you know, not being in a prison or even getting out after 8 years. But there's really not much of another choice. This is not a surrender negotiation. The FARC continue to have about 8,000 fighters on the battlefield. So if the choice is this or just keep fighting for what could be another 20 years, this is probably the best choice.
What has been the role of Cuba and the Cuban government in bringing these parties together?
Well, Cuba has hosted the talks, and together with Norway, they have both served as what are called the guarantor countries of the talks. And in the past three failed attempts to negotiate, things sort of fell apart and they got, you know, lost. They left the agenda behind and got lost on tangents. These countries actually have helped them stay to the agenda and also to get through crises that happened, you know, when an incident happens on the battlefield, and make sure that everything gets papered over and everything gets back on track. They've had some very skilled diplomats from both countries who have really made a huge difference.
We're talking about atrocities on both sides. The FARC are Marxist rebels. They made that very clear. Will they gain political legitimacy if, in fact, the deal goes through?
They may. Their plan certainly is to form a political movement or a party after a negotiation is concluded. And there has been space for the left in Colombia. The current mayor of Bogota is a former guerrilla from a different group, for instance. But the FARC are super unpopular. One of the main ways they raised money over the years was kidnapping, and they kidnapped about 20,000 people over the last 25 years for ransom. Any Gallup poll in Colombia, and they take them every 2 months, shows the FARC with a 3 or 4% approval rating. So they've got a long way to climb if they want to be a successful political movement.
When the Pope was in Havana, he said, we cannot allow failure on this path of peace, presumably referring to this deal.
Yeah.
Did they try to get it done while he was there?
They really wanted to get this accord hammered out by the time he was there, and they spent about the last 2 weeks working, you know, burning the candle at both ends to do it. It turns out, you know, they announced this on Wednesday. The Pope left Cuba on Tuesday morning, so they just barely missed it. Clearly, the Pope knew about this. I think that was the message when he said what he said about, you guys, you're losing an opportunity. Don't lose this opportunity. He must have known that, you know, they wanted to do this, and he was probably disappointed that they didn't hammer it out in time.
You mentioned 20,000 kidnappings. How many people have been killed?
According to the Historical Memory Commission in Colombia, a government body, they've counted about 220,000 killed since the early 1960s in Colombia.
And how many of those were killed by the rebels? How many were killed by the military organizations, the militias that you mentioned?
Very, very roughly, it's about 20% guerrillas, perhaps 70%, 60 or 70% paramilitaries, and maybe 10% military.
Wow. So even though the FARC are the most unpopular, they're not necessarily the most guilty.
No, the paramilitaries were the champions in terms of massacres, torture, and extrajudicial killings. But the FARC did a lot of killings, and they are the champions with kidnappings and attacks on populations. You know, you take a category and you have different people who are who lead, although everybody participated in some of it. Nobody's wearing a white hat here.
What about the compensation for victims?
The Colombia is passed a law in 2011 that already will set aside as much as $20 billion over 10 years to give compensation for victims. They've identified about 5.9 million people in this country of 48 million who already qualify for some sort of reward, and they're slowly bureaucratically working through that, which is hard to do while the conflict's still happening. That number will probably grow as people feel safer in FARC-controlled areas to talk about the dead that they had to quietly bury in the past. And, you know, reparations will have to come from the FARC's coffers. We'll find out how deep those coffers are soon. But a lot of it will probably have to come from Colombian taxpayers and the Colombian government just trying to set everything right.
And hardly a rich country. Final question, and the most important. Do you think they'll be able to work it out in the 6 months that they've got left?
Yes, I actually very much do. They just finished the hardest part of the agenda. Some of the remaining issues like disarmament and ceasefire are, you know, they're thorny, but they're not as nowhere near as hard as this transitional justice agreement they just agreed to. So I think they are on a downhill slope toward an accord, and I do think also they can probably get it done by March.
Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy for the Washington Office on Latin America. That's, again, a human rights organization. Thank you so much for being on our program.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.